So we have reason to think that when you're poor, you end up with worse psychological outcomes. There's also increasing evidence that when you have stress or depression, you don't have particularly good economic outcomes, especially in the case of serious mental health problems. And so from that perspective, there is a feedback loop.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. But does being rich make us happy, or is it just being richer than other people that matters? Will interventions that alleviate poverty also improve someone's well-being? Does stress discourage or inspire us at work? And if we can improve a person's mental health, does this have an economic effect as well? Johannes Haushofer of the National University of Singapore and Daniel Salikat of the Norwegian Labour and Welfare Administration recently published a working paper that summarises what we know so far about the psychology of poverty, and it suggests many ways in which future research can help us understand these and many more important questions. And they join me now. Johannes, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
And Daniel, welcome as well.
Hi, Tim.
Johannes, this has been something that economists have been studying for a long time. They've tended to study the sort of macro relationship between income and well-being. What have they found out? And are those results holding up now? Because we have a lot more data on this.
Yeah, that's true. There's an old literature from the 1970s on the relationship between income and well-being across countries, but also within countries. And the original finding was that there is a positive correlation between people's income and things like how happy they are or how satisfied with their lives they are within countries. So rich people in a country are happier than poor people in the same country. But there wasn't initially thought to be that same relationship across countries. So rich countries weren't thought to be happier than poor countries on average. And with the advent of new bigger and better data sets, that has been overturned. So we now know that there is a relationship both within and across countries. So rich people in a country are happier than poor people in the same country. And also rich countries on average are happier and more satisfied.
So can we confidently say now that there is a relationship between either, well, income or growth and well-being, happiness, satisfaction?
Yes, I would say that's the case. So like I mentioned, both within countries and across countries, there seems to be a correlation between income and well-being. That's levels of income. There also seems to be a relationship between growth. So as people and countries get richer, they tend to get happier. So there's also a relationship between growth and well-being.
Are we phrasing this carefully at the moment? We're saying there's a relationship between. These are correlations. How can we attempt to rescue some sort of causal connection in either direction between sort of, you know, wealth to happiness, happiness to wealth?
There's a couple of ways of doing this. One prominent one that's been explored a lot recently in the economics literature and also in other fields is looking at improvements in people's economic situation. So for example, through unconditional cash transfers or other sorts of aid programs, we can ask whether when people get a program like that, they end up happier and more satisfied with their lives.
Yes, let's talk about some of these experiments that have been done. We've discussed them on VoxDev a few times when there are RCTs using cash or asset transfers. And now many of them are collecting data on well-being for the treated group and control group, of course. Is there an impact on well-being that we can detect? And we're talking about well-being. What actually are we measuring here?
Maybe let me start with that second question. Typically, the way this is measured in these studies is through self-report. So people get asked a question like, taking all things together, how happy are you with your life as a whole these days? Or how satisfied are you with your life? Mm-hmm. There are other ways of measuring it, such as yesterday, what kinds of emotions have you experienced? How often have you felt sad? How much of the time have you felt happy? And so on. But they're all very strongly correlated with one another. So it's basically asking people, are you happy? you can boil it down to that. And by and large, these studies show that when you give people money or when you give them some other sort of support, they do end up psychologically better off. They end up happier and more satisfied. That's not true in all studies and not true for all programs, but on the whole, there is a pretty robust effect. There's a really nice meta-analysis by Joel McGuire and colleagues that shows this very robustly for cash transfers. So if you look at many cash transfer programs that have been done, on average, they quite strongly improve psychological well-being of the recipients.
Is this definitely improving the well-being of the recipients, or is it a sort of zero-sum game where they're comparing themselves to other people who didn't get the cash transfer, who might then have a negative effect on their well-being?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's obviously a huge worry in these programs. Mm. If we're just making the neighbors less happy, that's a significant concern. And there isn't a lot of evidence to suggest that that's the case. And in contrast, there are some evidence to suggest that even the neighbors are better off. So often these cash transfer programs have economic spillovers that are positive. So the whole village ends up being better off after a few people get a cash transfer. And that's simply because the cash transfer in the pockets of some people ends up as spending in the pockets of other people. And so everybody's a little bit better off. And perhaps because of that, the spillovers on psychological well-being have also been found to be positive in some cases. So then even the neighbors or other people in the village end up being psychologically better off after their neighbors get cash transfers. That's not always the case. There's some examples to the contrary. And I would say that's an area where the jury's out a little bit, but we've certainly seen some compelling evidence of positive spillovers.
In the paper, you've also focused on the psychological impact of scarcity. What do we mean by scarcity?
I think that's a really good question, especially given the fact that the term scarcity is used quite differently in the literature. Why is that? Well, I think it might come from its original definition, which is quite broad. So it refers to scarcity as having less than you feel you need.
Yeah.
And this clearly leaves some room for interpretation.
Yes.
So what do we really mean when we talk about the impact of scarcity? Well, the main idea is that scarcity consumes cognitive resources of those exposed to it, and thereby impacts their decision-making. So being exposed to scarcity can both reduce a person's overall mental bandwidth and redirect attention towards short-term, income-relevant features of a decision. So this comes at the expense of maybe other aspects which are less apparent, but important also in the long term. It's often described as tunnel vision, where your attention narrows to the most pressing concerns instead of seeing the big picture. So, for example, you can imagine you are in a situation of financial scarcity where you're anxiously awaiting for an important payment. Maybe you're uncertain about the size of this payment. And being in this state of scarcity, you are more likely to prioritize choices which have an immediate effect and are most income relevant, while at the same time neglecting considerations that are important for your long-term financial situation. So to sum it up, when we discuss the impact of scarcity, we're examining how scarcity impacts your mental bandwidth and shift your attention towards urgent income-related matters, often at the expense of broader, equally significant considerations.
I was talking a minute ago to Yannis about the impact of cash transfers, and there have been a lot of experiments that have given a cash transfer. Is it possible to do experiments where we test scarcity? It would not seem to be ethically correct to put people into a position of scarcity to test how they react to it.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. So first of all, when considering testing this link between, say, scarcity and psychological outcomes, I think it's really important to state that one should not actively push participants into a situation of scarcity. Still, it's an important topic. We want to provide valuable advice to policymakers, and it's important that we understand these effects better, and then that we understand these effects for those affected by it. So therefore, when we set up such a study to test this link, it's important to focus on the right identification strategies that select only individuals that are already in the situation of scarcity, and rather try to lift some of them out of this situation and compare the different effect between those treatment groups.
So when we're thinking about the impacts of scarcity, from the research that's been done, what results seem robust?
Well, one effect that stands out, as it has been replicated consistently, is the increase in time discounting under conditions of scarcity. So showing that there's a higher preference for smaller immediate rewards over larger delayed ones, which is a manifestation of present bias.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's here also important to note that while this effect is well established, the mechanism behind it remain unclear. So some people will argue that these effects are due to psychological effects of scarcity, while others claim that they are due to people being liquidity constrained. So still more work to be done on this area. But still, there is this one robust finding established. However, for other outcomes, the effects are quite mixed, mm-hmm, and do not show such a robust pattern. So recent studies on how scarcity impacts cognitive function show quite mixed results and put earlier findings into question. And when it comes to risk and social preferences, there are still too few studies to conclude how these are impacted by scarcity. So here we still need to learn more. However, I think it's worth noting that there are several interesting recent extensions to this research on scarcity. For example, a recent study by Kaur and co-authors used an experiment to manipulate the amount of cash on hand available to manufacturing workers in India. Mm-hmm. And what they find in this study is that for these workers that were randomly allocated to have cash-rich days, they make fewer mistakes and they increase their output. So this, I think, is really important because it illustrates the potential economic cost of scarcity and show how scarcity can affect outcomes such as productivity.
Yes, and it's very, very interesting to see how these effects manifest in day-to-day life. Now, there is also the term stress in research. It's important to be careful with our terms on this. So I'm going to ask you about that.
So that's a literature that I've been involved in a little bit. And I initially had a relatively clear sense that stress would increase people's impatience and make them more risk averse. And certainly there were a number of studies that showed this and also perhaps make them a little less pro-social, but it's really the evidence, if anything, has become less conclusive over the years. So I think, to me at least, no longer clear whether stress has any effect on these outcomes, and if yes, what it is. There is an emerging literature on the effects of stress on competitiveness. Mm-hmm. So under stress, people tend to shy away from entering competition somewhat more than they do under no stress conditions. That's still an emerging literature. So it's also somewhat new. There's a good chance I'll say the same thing as I say about time and risk and social preferences about that finding in a few years. But that's quite intriguing, and I'm excited to see where that literature goes.
So it is interesting to see how difficult some of this research is and how we must be careful about interpreting results. Some of the very interesting research that's coming out at the moment is programs that attempt directly to improve mental health, psychological state as part of a route out of poverty. What sort of interventions are we talking about here?
There's been a flurry of activity in that literature recently, both in economics and in other fields. And I'd say there are broadly two flavors of intervention. One is very light touch interventions that often last just an hour or so that are often relatively targeted. So, for example, they might try to raise people's aspirations and get them to think bigger about their future. Mm-hmm. And there's others that are more full-on psychotherapy programs that try to help people with their well-being more generally, perhaps if they have depression or anxiety or something like that. And in both cases, people have recently gotten interested in the question whether these interventions are not just beneficial for people's psychological well-being, but also have economic benefits. So, for example, an aspirations intervention might motivate people to invest more in the education of their kids or in their businesses. Mm-hmm. Psychotherapy program might help people not just be less depressed, but also more productive in the workplace. And we're learning that both of these kinds of interventions seem to have some positive effects on economic outcomes. I would say the literature on the light touch interventions is still relatively new and growing, and so we should be careful, but there's certainly some encouraging results there. These more heavy-handed interventions like psychotherapy, I think we have good reason to think now that they have not just psychological, but also economic benefits.
They may have these benefits, but these type of interventions, they can be quite complex to deliver and they can be quite expensive as well. So is there an argument that perhaps it would be more useful to just give the money you would spend on those interventions to the poor people who you are trying to help, because we know that that's going to improve their psychological state?
I don't think that's an unreasonable thought to have at all. And yeah, there have been some comparisons. I have a comparison in my own work that is more in favor of the cash transfer than the psychotherapy program. Other papers show the opposite. The reason being that these psychotherapy programs actually can be relatively inexpensive compared to cash transfer. So I agree with you, there are some that are quite costly, but others are very cheap to deliver, especially if, as often the case in these programs, when they're deployed in low-income settings, they're delivered by trained lay people, mm-hmm. and that's relatively low cost. And so the cost effectiveness can be pretty good. One thing to note in that context is that the way that cost effectiveness is measured for these mental health interventions is typically by looking at the dollars spent per improved unit in the mental health outcome. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bit unfair to the cash transfer or to whatever other broader economic intervention you might want to compare it to, because that, of course, has additional effects quite directly on economic outcomes. Now, the mental health intervention might also have those, but less directly. And so I would say we don't have a clear picture at the moment of which is more effective if you're interested in improving some combination of mental health and economic outcomes. When it comes to economic outcomes per se, I would probably put my money on cash transfer still at the moment.
So is it possible that there is some kind of feedback loop between our psychological well-being and economic outcomes that might trap people in poverty?
So we have reason to think that when you're poor, you end up with worse psychological outcomes. There's also increasing evidence that when you have stress or depression, you don't have particularly good economic outcomes, especially in the case of serious mental health problems. And so from that perspective, there is a feedback loop. When economists talk about a poverty trap, they have something very specific in mind, where there's a very strong relationship between the two and you actually get stuck and you need a really large intervention in order to get out of it. And for that very narrow definition of a poverty trap, I don't think the evidence is currently very good. But that's not to say that there isn't such a feedback loop. And that's still very important for policy. I do think we have reason to think there's a causal effect in both directions.
Now, several times in this conversation, we've talked about how the evidence points in two directions or that we perhaps need a little bit more research. What important gaps do you think exist at the moment in our understanding of the psychology of poverty?
I think that in the area of the impact of scarcity that we talked about earlier, for example, many different identification strategies have been used. Many different ways of using established outcome measures have been used in many different settings. And this has provided a quite mixed overview. So I think that's one very promising area for future research is to narrow down where the effects that we have been seeing, where they come from, what are really the mechanisms behind these effects and try to understand that. I think that is something that we are starting to understand better, but we still have a lot of things to learn about.
When it comes to these psychotherapy programs that I mentioned earlier, I think we're still at the beginning of understanding what exactly they can do for people's economic situation. One important area of growth, I think, is to make these programs more targeted, both in terms of the people that they're delivered to and in terms of the substance of the intervention. So what problems they specifically target. At the moment, they're often delivered to general population samples with a one-size-fits-all kind of approach, and making them more specific seems like a useful thing to do. The public health community is already many steps ahead in this. They're customizing these programs now, and I think it's going to be really exciting to see what that gives for economic outcomes.
It's a fascinating area of research, and we don't know exactly the answers to some of the questions that you're investigating. I look forward to talking to you again about this in the future. But for now, thank you very much. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
Johannes, thank you as well.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
The paper is called The Psychology of Poverty, Where Do We Stand? Johannes Haushofer and Daniel Salicata are the authors. It is NBER Working Paper 31977, if you want to look it up that way. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to follow us. Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find us there. All our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where we also have articles about the papers and the subjects that we feature.